In our last session, we just touched on the 73 war, and I'm going to go back to that. And just before the 73 Yom Kippur War started, Egypt started heavily propagandizing the environment. They were having different Muslim groups trying as hard as they could to say that they were going to attack, you know, let everybody think that the attack was coming really, really soon. Syria joined in with Egypt, and they were going to attack too. Everybody was making preparations. The Jews knew it was going to happen, but the Jews knew that until Egypt got some Scud missiles and some more planes, that they weren't going to attack. And the Israeli intelligence started calling this whole thing the conception. That was their assessment, that Egypt is not going to war until they get the necessary armaments. Well, the October war began on Saturday, October the 6th, 1973, which is the Jewish Sabbath. And it was Yom Kippur, the highest holy day in their year. And most of the Israelis were fasting and praying, including the military. So they were caught by surprise, and they suffered a lot of casualties as a result of this. The Egyptians had this advantage of a surprise. They crossed the Suez Canal, and on October the 7th, on October 7th, they got across the canal, and the Syrian forces advanced on the Golan Heights. I put a map in your notes showing you what the strategic locations were of the Egyptians crossing the Nile and where they went into the Sinai. And so it was just before 2 o'clock on Saturday, October the 6th, they came into the Sinai with 222 warplanes, and they took off from seven different airfields, and they flew really low bombing missions. So, because they weren't afraid of the anti-aircraft, because it was Yom Kippur, so they could be more effectively bombing and the Israeli targets in the Sinai. The next map shows the Syrian attack from the Golan Heights up on the northeastern side of Israel, just to the north and the east of the Sea of Galilee, although they call it the Lake of Kinneret now. In the meantime, 60 airplanes took off just outside the Golan Heights and started to bomb the Israeli folks that were in the southwestern Golan Heights, and there was a fierce and intense barrage of fighting going on there. It's interesting to know a little bit about the Golan Heights. It's a very key military and safeguard, if you will, buffer zone up on the north and east of the Sea of Galilee. the heights are roughly the size of a borough of New York called Queens, and it's about 15 and a half miles wide at its widest point. And the Sea of Galilee is Israel's most our best water source. And the map that I've placed in your notes there shows the size of the Golan Heights, and the maroon area is the area that they took in this battle. When the Jews finally got their sea legs, so to speak, or their war legs, and started fighting back, they were extremely successful, and they reversed the tide of the battle. They got 10 kilometers beyond the 1967 ceasefire lines, beyond the Golan Heights up into Syria. And on the Egyptian front, the Israelis crossed the canal, the Suez Canal, on the 14th, and they surrounded the Egyptian Third Army. The Israelis are blessed by God. God wants them to stay in that country. That's his property. He's given them these victories on a regular basis. They surrounded the Egyptian Third Army, and the fighting continued even after an agreement to stop on October the 22nd. The USSR and the United States almost got in a confrontation over this, because the United States started helping Israel and the USSR started helping the Muslim nations. Finally, there was a U.S.-Soviet Security Council resolution with the U.N. that everybody accepted a ceasefire here on October the 26th. The Egyptians refused to accept it initially, and the Soviets had this airlift where they were bringing continually more supplies, more military supplies into Egypt. Saudi Arabia decides that they're going to have an oil embargo. This was their reaction to the 73 war, Yom Kippur war. They shut off the oil to the Western nations. And a lot of us were here at that time. We know how chaotic that was. It was not good. So Secretary of State Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, who's still alive, he goes over there and he tries to broker a deal for a couple of months. It wasn't a great deal for the Israelis. He wasn't a great friend of the Jews, even though he is Jewish. He concentrates on getting Israel to withdraw to the Six-Day War, 1967, war lines. And he's trying to get them to get them away from their encirclement of the Third Egyptian Army. He's trying to broker an exchange of prisoners, and he wants them to withdraw from about 20 kilometers away from the Nile and the Nile Delta and the Suez Canal, and he wants both armies to be reduced. He's trying to broker a deal where both armies back off on the number of people they have in the army. They called it a disengagement agreement, and it was signed by Israel and Egypt on June the 18th in 1974. Syria kept fighting. They didn't want to stop. They just kept going, and they finally signed an agreement on May the 31st of the same year. And Israel agreed to give back that extra property that they had gotten on the northeast side of the Golan Heights. So they did that, basically retract back to the 1967 area. And there was a buffer zone that was created on both fronts. And there was a U.S. memorandum giving, a U.S. memorandum of understanding. You know, none of these treaties ever last, and none of them ever work. And the United States is constantly trying to do something to broker a peace deal. The problem with these peace deals is they all want Israel to give something to the other guys, the bad guys, so to speak, to stop the fighting. But it's always a straw man. The Muslims set up a straw man and say the Israelis are bad, and you've got to get them to give us some property. I mean, little Israel is always being asked to give property. Now, just like the Fedayeen attacks between 1951 and 1956, we have something called the Intifada. The Intifada just means, in Arab terms, it means just shaking off. Israel's enemies realized after this Yom Kippur War and how badly they got their clocks clean, so to speak, that they're never going to beat Israel. So we're going to have to do it politically. We're going to go out on the world scene and we're going to start making disparaging comments about Israel. We're going to call them an occupier, that they don't have a rightful claim to that property, even though the UN gave it to them. Everybody wanted them to have it back in 1947 and 1948. And I got a little thing there in your notes that Churchill realized their military prowess. Now, he died about 63, but long before then, he realized how militarily superior they were. And there's plenty of his writings, and he did help the Jews a lot. But the whole world turned to this diplomatic warfare, and they tried to weaken Israel's diplomatic position. Constantly going to the media, constantly going to other nations, and constantly trying to get the other nations to break off with Israel, diplomatic relations. The Muslim world pressurized the African nations and most of the third world countries in Southeast Asia to break off diplomatic relations with Israel, and they did. In 1975, the Soviet Muslim Third World bloc, if you will, succeeded in getting the United Nations to proclaim, which is really crazy, that Zionism equals racism. It's absolutely crazy that people actually believe this stuff and then they do it. It was just an attempt to try and say that Israel shouldn't exist as a state. This thing finally got revoked in 1991, but it was a long time where this resolution stood at the United Nations and the Muslims were constantly bringing this up. Zionism equals racism. They just hate us. They're trying as hard as they can to wipe us out, when exactly it's the opposite that's true. And all you can say is Hudna. Hudna. It's absolutely Hudna. You know, and that's obviously the Muslim's term for I can do anything I want and lie as long as I couch it all under Hudna. Here's a guy. This was a devout Muslim, wrote this book called Jihad in Islam in 1991. S.A.A. Madaudi. Islam wishes to destroy all states and governments anywhere on the face of the earth, which is opposed to the ideology and program of Islam. Islam requires the earth, not just a portion of it, but the whole planet, and that God's law, Sharia, should be enforced in the world by force of arms. Truth cannot be confined within geographical borders. The allegiance of a Muslim does not rest on his domicile in the country, which is his, but on the faith to which he belongs. Wherever there is the rule of Islam, there is his own country. And I put in parentheses that he didn't say that. In other words, a caliphate. They want a caliphate. Now, this guy is not an independent thinker that's coming up with something that's outside the norm. This is Islam. Now, I just want to review what we've looked at here about Islam, that they started off with military efforts right with Muhammad. They started by the sword, and they lasted about 100 years with massive expansion until they got up to southwestern France, and Charles Martel stopped them there in 732. He slaughtered thousands of them. That was only 100 years after Muhammad died, and they had conquered the Arabian Peninsula, Turkey. They'd gone east, and they got into northern Africa and up in the Iberian Peninsula, and they were heading up to Europe. They were going to take it all when Charles Martel stopped them. They believe that they need to conquer the world. They just need to conquer the world. Qital is the slaying of and warfare to achieve their means. Jihad is the holy war that they think they should be engaging in. Now, in its original form, jihad means striving with the dedication of maximum effort to the undertaking of converting everybody to Islam. And if they don't convert, you kill them. There's no substance whatsoever to the new argument, which is Hudna, that you hear about. Well, jihad is really a fight within ourselves to adhere to God's will. It's trying to bend our will to God's will. Moral endeavor and self-discipline to Islam. That's absolute Hudna. That's not at all what the Quran says. That's not anything that anybody's ever taught. That's a commonly contemporary applied meaning to jihad to soften the liberal media so that they will promote Muslims. That's all that they're doing. It's just one big lie. Now, I'm going to read a few verses from the Quran, and you can see what the Quran says. Who is he that will loan to God a beautiful loan, which God will double in their credit and multiply many times? Allah has given those that fight with their goods and their persons a higher rank than those who stay at home. He has promised all a good reward, but far richer is the recompense of those who fight for him. Rank of his own bestowal, forgiveness and mercy. Those who believe suffer exile and strive with might and main in God's cause with their goods and their persons have the highest rank in the sight of God. Those who fought in the path of God have the hope of the mercy of God. Those who fall on the battlefield in the course of holy wars become martyrs. Those that fought and died for my cause shall be forgiven their sins and admitted to gardens watered by running streams. Think not of those who are slain in God's way as dead. They are alive and well provided by their Lord. And finally, as for those who are slain in the cause of Allah, he will not allow their works to perish. He will admit them to the paradise he has made known to them. They are told they have to engage in a struggle. They have to engage in a struggle. And they've got other verses that show that God doesn't like you when you don't fight. And how should you not fight in the cause of Allah for the helpless? You know, there's only a few verses that refer to particular battles. Most of them are the general jihad, and the battles that they refer to in the Quran are like the battles of Badr and Uhud, which goes back to Muhammad. It's March the 13th to 624. We looked at that weeks and weeks and weeks ago. Battles he fought in, just conquering people and killing thousands and beheading thousands to try and get control over them. It's a means to conquer, and it's given this fuel by this belief that they have to do this. They have this constant hostility to anybody that is not a Muslim. A constant hostility. If you've been with any of them, you see that. They look at you like you're just absolutely nothing, and they're going to take you over because this is their world. And what they've been doing in Israel is this intifada. It's continuing today. It's permanent war. It means the shaking off, as I'd mentioned, and it's an uprising where they just have the suicide bombers and these stealth attacks where they kill innocent people. They got demonstrations, strikes, riots, anything that they can do to disrupt Israeli life and now European life and some here. There's general violence in the Gaza Strip and parts of Judea and Samaria that they call the West Bank. The three principal groups that have been involved in this, I know you've heard these names, Islamic Jihad, the PLO, and Hamas. Hezbollah is another one, but those are the three principal. Hezbollah has gotten a lot of publicity in the last 10 years or so. But Islamic Jihad and Hamas both have called for an independent state for the so-called Palestinians. Now, the PLO's goal has been to organize terrorist attacks on Israel. That's their goal. Organize these terrorist attacks. And I told you where they came from. They were in the internment camps because their Arab brethren would not let them in to their own countries. They kept them there. They did this intentionally. The Gaza Strip and the West Bank, so to speak, has been a seedbed of violence. I mean, that's where these people start. Now they're up in Lebanon. Hezbollah has got control of Lebanon. And the violence is coming from there. And there's also groups that are trained militarily in Iran that are being sent over to Israel now. This is going to continue. This fight is going to continue until the Lord sends Gog, who's the Russian leader, and all the Muslim nations with the southeastern Europeans, the Germans, if you will, the sons of Japheth, in the Allied invasion. We'll start talking about that next week. I'll do one or two sessions on that. We can see what ends up happening is that all of those people that come against Israel are killed, and none of the Israelis are. That takes them off the political map, where they will no longer have world political prowess. They're still going to be there, still going to be Russians, still going to be plenty of Muslims, but they're not going to have the same political power. So what's happened? I mean, the Intifada still goes on. We read about this every day. Something's happening. So they don't stop. Ariel Sharon was an incredible general. I mean, he was just the hawk of hawks. Incredible guy. He was born in 1928. He was part of the War of Independence. He was 20, and he was a paratrooper. He would be the equivalent of an Army Ranger for that army at that time. I mean, the guy was just incredible. And he became the prime minister. And, you know, I remember when he became the prime minister, I thought, oh, man, this is great, you know. He is really going to do some great things. He's going to be fighting these guys now really bad. But the whole time, the world pressure against Israel as the aggressor, as the Zionist racist, as the bad guys, as the occupiers, has been for them to give some of their land up for peace, which is absolutely crazy. There is no substitute for peace. There's nothing you can exchange for it. You can't do it. You can't do it. You can't give anything to somebody that's unreasonable to be peaceful. Because the Arabs or the Muslims, they just embrace everything with a hudna. That's like, you know, when we were kids, you cross your fingers behind your back and you say, sure, I'll do this. You know, and you show your fingers and say, ah, it doesn't mean anything. That's what they do. The same thing. It's just as infantile as that. There's been this suggestion that these so-called Palestinians have their own state. And if they granted them a state, the Palestinians would then renounce their violence, make democratic reforms, and that Israel would welcome them as an independent state. So what was being asked of Israel at the time that Sharon was the prime minister was, well, let's get them to give up the Gaza Strip, and let's get Israel to give up Judea and Samaria. That's what they got in the 67 war. They got the Gaza Strip from Egypt, and they got the West Bank, so to speak, from Jordan. So what happens? What happens? They try and the UN tries and broker a deal. George Bush gets involved, and he was trying to broker a deal with Sharon. And they came up with this, they called it the roadmap. That was the acronym for it, the roadmap, or not the acronym, but that was the description of it. The peace plan. And they wanted to have peace by 2005 with a Palestinian state created in Judea and Samaria and the Gaza Strip. And they had several stages and a timetable that they laid out for this thing. Israel says, we're not talking to anybody unless you get Yasser Arafat out of this. Get him out of the PLO. Because Yasser Arafat was a chronic liar. He was a terrorist. He was a murderer. He was one of the sleaziest humans that has ever lived on this planet. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon starts gradually warming up to this idea. He says, wow, there's so many people involved in this now. Maybe it could work. Maybe it could work. His cabinet takes a much more aggressive stance. They want to push it. And so he's sort of getting pushed along in this process. He says, you know, I can sort of see how the Palestinians could conceivably get their own state. But, you know, I'm not going to freeze construction in Gaza or Judea and Samaria and kick all the Jews out of there. They've been living there for over 20 years. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. And he said that they need those towns because there's a natural growth for the inhabitants there. We can't just kick them out. We can't shut down the construction. So in 2003, George Bush, who's a friend of Israel, major friend of Israel, and Ariel Sharon, he goes over there, and after he leaves, Hamas starts attacking. And Israel responds. They aggressively respond with force, and the violence stopped the peace process. The whole peace process just stopped. Israel is not the aggressor. Never has been the aggressor, but they're going to hang on to the property that's theirs. There was a tentative ceasefire that was reached between the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, and four major terror groups. There's one Islamic Jihad, Hamas, one called the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and Arafat started his own group after he got pushed out of the PLO. It's called the Fatah Movement. And there was a new president of the PLO called Abbas, who's still the president of the PLO. He's very ineffective. He can't control any of these people. You know, you can go to him and they can make a deal with him. He can't control any of these people. They still want to all kill Israel. That's the goal of the Muslims. So he can't stop that stuff. By August of that same year, Hamas had stepped up the suicide bombings, and Israel did not pull out its troops or stop construction or pull people out of the Gaza Strip or Judea and Samaria. So in 2004, George Bush sends a letter to Sharon, and he gives support to Israel. He said, keep the settlement construction, and we're not going to give the Palestinians unlimited rights to come back into those regions. In June, Sharon gets involved in a land for peace deal. He proposes, I mean, this was so strange. He proposes a unilateral, meaning one way. Look, we are the Jews. We'll give you the Gaza. We'll give you the West Bank. And we'll pull out. The Israelis went absolutely nuts. They had riots. They were screaming at them. They were having demonstrations at the Wailing Wall. Sharon's claiming that if we can pull out, though, the world is going to have sympathy towards us and see that we're trying real hard here to broker this peace deal. And they said, look, we're going to compensate the families that are there. We're going to give them other places to live. They're going to lose their homes. And they tried to keep the Jews that they were pushing out of there from coming back in, but they kept sneaking back in. And what they ended up doing was they ended up sending the army in to take the Jews out of their homes. They carried them off. The Jews are hanging on to their doors and openings in their houses and windows and that. And the Israeli Defense Forces are carrying these people out. I mean, it was unbelievably sad. Unbelievably sad that, you know, attracted a huge group that went to the Wailing Wall here. 250,000 Jews went to the Wailing Wall and protested this. But the IDF took them all out. They took every one of them, and they had to be dragged out and carried out. It was just terrible. I can only imagine how bad these armed forces felt about having to do this. You know, here's Ariel Sharon, one of the biggest hawks they've ever had, turns his whole ideology around and turns on the Jews. He thinks there's going to be some diplomatic prowess that he's going to get out of this on the world stage. All it did was just escalate the violence. The Arabs saw what they were doing, the Muslims, and they just started rising up even harsher. When the people were finally evacuated. But they've been there for 38 years. 38 years. They were finally out of there. They didn't know what to do with all these people. They were primarily agriculturally driven with their economic prowess. They were homeless. There was a ton of bureaucratic red tape to try and get them retrained. They were unqualified to work in any jobs in industry, and they brought in psychologists, sociologists, and a bunch of people to try and help them retrain. And it was terrible. It was absolutely terrible for the Jews. Sharon suffers a stroke. He has a stroke, and he is still in a permanent vegetative state today. I'll tell you what, God is in control. God is not going to let that land go away from his Jews. It's not going to happen. You can just look at it over history, how slow it's been for them coming back. The situation in Gaza now is just completely deteriorated. There's political disorder. A bunch of Palestinians even fled there and went to Egypt because there wasn't enough jobs, and even they didn't like the violence. The fighting between Hamas and Arafat's group Fatah escalated, and by June of 2007, Hamas had taken over the government in Gaza. It's no longer a democracy. You got a terrorist group, a group of murdering thugs that control the little government down there. They create a police state. They shut down the newspapers. The Christian citizens in Gaza were harassed and assaulted. They start having rocket attacks on Israel again. And Israel is forced to respond. So they respond with something they called an Operation Cast Lead. Just firing back at them. And that lasted for 3 weeks between the end of December of 2008 and January 2009. And the world looks at Israel and says, well, you're using excessive force on these poor Palestinian people. The road to peace led nowhere. It did not happen. It is never going to happen until Christ comes back. There is no peace brokered anywhere in this world, least of all God's property. Amen?